Murphy was the son of a builder, but it's his marriage to Julia Lombard, who came from a wealthy Cork family, which paved the road to his business empire, which was built in railways, property, and later newspapers. He was a shrewd, innovative entrepreneur who embraced new technologies and certainly shaped modern Ireland.
Across the Atlantic Sea, but he never tried to go railing from Menace as far as Kilkenny.
He moved out of building fairly quickly. He discovered that there was a fortune to be made in building light rail. The British government brought in a system of subsidising light rail to build a network, particularly into more remote parts of the country, and to tackle poverty in areas like the congested districts boards on the west coast. The West Clare Railway was one of his railways, which famously commemorated in the Percy French song.
Are you right there, Michael, are you right? Do you think that we'll be home before the night? Ah, you've been so long and starting that you couldn't say for certain, still you might. Now, Michael, so you might.
I suppose William Martin Murphy was very innovative in a sense when it came to the press. The Irish Independent in particular was an exciting new publication from the early 20th century, which used cartoons and which was bright when lots of the competition, like the Freeman's Journal, for example, was fairly dour. So that was reflected in the market share. He was also innovative in terms of distribution, getting his paper down the country in time for the rural readership. So he's quite a dynamic newspaper proprietor.
That's John Cunningham from NUI Galway. Mark O'Brien is a media historian at Dublin City University, and he sees a direct link between Murphy's success in railways and in newspapers.
So Murphy took advantage of all these trends that were occurring in the newspaper business at that time and reinvented the Irish Daily Independent into what we now know as the Irish Independent. And it was hugely successful from the get-go. In its early days, it had a circulation of around 26,000 copies. By 1915, it was selling 100,000 copies. A key aspect to that was Murphy's involvement in the railway industry. As we think about distribution, what is a newspaper? It needs to be distributed.
Are you right there, Michael? Are you right? Do you think that you can get the fire to light?
This was at a time when the Irish Times, for example, was selling around 35,000 copies a day, and only within the real urban areas, Dublin, Cork, and Galway. There was no real newspaper penetration of the country as such. Murphy changed that with his involvement in the railways because he was able to ensure that the Irish Independent was distributed throughout the country. Every nook and cranny could get a copy of the Irish Independent, and that's what built up the circulation success of the Irish Independent.
And as you're wobbling through the dark, you hear the guard make this remark.
Murphy recruited a well-known and very experienced journalist, Timothy Harrington, as the editor of the new Irish Independent. In Harrington's papers, you know, there's correspondence between Harrington and Murphy, where Harrington is very strong in the idea of the Independent being an independent entity and not being tied to any political party. By and large, Murphy very much acquiesced in that policy. That changed in 1912, 1913. And the reason it changed was Murphy's commercial base. This upstart Larkin was organising the unskilled workers of Dublin, demanding pay rises, and all the politics aside, it was a commercial challenge to Murphy's dominance. It's very clear that the Irish Independent took a very anti-Larkin line, and that anti-Larkin line could have only have come from Murphy. It was a clash of the titans, James Larkin versus William Martin Murphy. Caught in between was this Irish Independent newspaper. When push comes to shove, Murphy ensured that the Irish Independent protected his commercial interest.
But if William Martin Murphy had the power of the press on his side, Jim Larkin and the trade union movement took their case to the streets. Here's Francis Devine.
In the absence of radio and television, and even allowing for the Irish worker and the printed media, much of the dispute and much of the politics of the day was conducted on the street corner. So one of Larkin's great gifts was this wonderful power of oratory. So people went to these meetings in their thousands, tens of thousands, and heard the message. And again, we're hearing being said publicly, perhaps what you whispered to your partner in bed at night or whispered in the corner of a pub. Here was Larkin actually challenging in public terms some of the corruption and so on. And again, from talking to people, as I did 30-odd years ago, who'd lived through it, some of those speeches would be relayed when those that attended came back to their own communities. And some of the phrases and catchphrases, and of course some of the slighting of Murphy and character assassination, if you like, of Murphy, would have been repeated.
Let people who desire to know the truth go to the factories and see the maimed girls, the weak and sickly, whose eyes are being put out and their bodies scarred and their souls seared when they are no longer able to be useful enough to gain their £1 a week or whatever wage they earned, were thrown onto the human scrap heap. These things were found to be in their midst, and yet the people who caused these conditions of wretchedness described working men as loafers. True it was that Mr. Murphy said that the Dublin workman was a decent man, but he would deny the right of the Dublin workmen to work in their city on terms of decency, on the streets or on the quays. He would deny their right to develop their activities and to receive proper and living wages.
And certainly those people that ever heard Larkin, the manner of his performance, the type of language that he used, the stentorian tones, very, very significant, and it made him a figure almost larger than life in a way that today you could only achieve perhaps by a YouTube clip or a soundbite on international media, CNN or something. So it was the same effect.
One of those convinced by the power of Larkin's oration is Constance Markovich, who writes almost in purple prose about the first time she saw and heard him speak.
Sitting there listening to Larkin, I realised I was in the presence of something I had never come across before. Some great primeval force, rather than a man. A tornado. A storm-driven wave. The rush into life of spring. And the blasting of breath of autumn all seemed to emanate from the power that spoke.
Porrick Yates sees Larkin's gift as charismatic, emotional, rather than intellectual.
Larkin's primary skill as an orator was to connect psychologically with the crowd. It's a bit like sort of Adolf Hitler, if you like. It's not what you say, it's how you say it. And he had this amazing capacity. I mean, my father would have heard Larkin speak, and he had this huge voice. It's like an opera singer, a powerful voice that could project over a crowd. I think someone who listened to him compared him to Shelly Appam, the great Russian bass singer, and he had that sort of powerful voice. It was how he said it that mattered.
It seemed as if his personality caught up, assimilated, and threw back to the vast crowd that surrounded him every emotion that swayed them, every pain and joy that they had ever felt, made articulate and sanctified. Only the great elemental force that is in all crowds had passed into his nature forever.
I have lived among the working classes all my life. I have starved because men denied me food. I worked very hard at an early age. But whatever opportunities I got, I availed of them. I'm called an antichrist and an atheist. If I were an atheist, I would not deny it. I am a socialist and have always claimed to be a socialist.
Taller than most men, every line of him was in harmony with his personality. Not so much working man as primeval man. Man without the trickeries or finickiness of modern civilization. A titan who might have been moulded by Michelangelo or Rodin. Such is Jim Larkin. From that day, I looked upon Larkin as a friend and was out to do any little thing I could to help him in his work.
Well, he was a big man. He had shock of very dark hair, quite a handsome figure. He was the son of two Armagh people who met on the boat on their way to Liverpool. They were part of the great diaspora that left Ireland after the famine. How much of it is true and how much it isn't, we don't know, because Larkin had a sort of a fairly casual relationship with the truth in some respects. And he was partly because he felt he had to assert his legitimacy when he was in Ireland by stressing his Irishness. He actually used to say he was born in Armagh, which was fine until people asked him for his birth certificate. And he used to get into all sorts of contortions then with his enemies.
Both James Connolly and Jim Larkin used to fudge their birthplaces. If Larkin said he was born in Armagh, Connolly swapped his Edinburgh roots for Monaghan, largely because they were attacked by the Dublin Employers' Federation as foreign agitators. Thomas Morrissey, Murphy's biographer, makes the point that both Murphy and his nemesis Larkin were staunch Christians, and that Larkin, an evangelical teetotaler, sought to elevate the working classes of Dublin with weekend picnics at Croydon Park, with the trade union bands, like the Fintan Lawlor Pipe Band, which made its debut in June 1913.
There's a great phrase of Sean O'Casey's that Larkin brought not only bread, but wine to the workers. He had this desire that the sort of the cultural things that the well-to-do enjoyed, the workers should be able to enjoy as well. So he's a man of great vision and extraordinary gift of oratory, but with seemingly little control over the amount of abuse he hurled at people on all sides. Very disorganized and a one-man show. But as they say, with a lion heart and a heart of gold and wanting what was best for the working people of Dublin.
He was driven by his ego, and any meeting he was in, he always tried to dominate it and assume leadership role within it. But no, his personality was extremely aggressive at times. By the way, one of his favourite sayings, and you don't often hear trade unionists using it, he used to insist on a fair day's work for a fair day's pay.
If William Martin Murphy has traditionally been seen as the demon of the peace, Larkin has been eulogised as a hero. Reality is a lot greyer. Helena Maloney, a colleague of Maud Gonne's in Inniad na hÉireann, saw Larkin's strengths and weaknesses.
The Irish working class were shamelessly underpaid. Unemployment was widespread. The dockers had to hang around the docks, waiting for work which mostly was not to be had. He dragged the unskilled workers up off their knees and did a great work. But between himself and James Connolly, there was a bitter feud. It was only a battle of temperaments, and I was on the side of James Connolly.
James Connolly clearly struggled with Larkin's ego, dominance, and his tendency to fall out with just about everyone he worked with.
I begin to fear that our friend Jim has arrived at his highest elevation, and that he'll pull us all down with him in his fall. He does not seem to want a democratic labour movement. He seems to want a Larkinite movement only. He must rule or will not work, and in the present stage of the labour movement, he has us at his mercy, and he knows it, and is using his power unscrupulously, I regret to say. We can but bow our head and try to avert the storm. I am sick of all this playing to one man, but I am prepared to advise it for the sake of the movement.
Both Connolly and Larkin had been instrumental in the formation of the Labour Party in 1912, but at this stage, it's closer to a trades council than a political party, and it's by no means a gathering of socialists.
And one of the big problems for the Labour Party, even at its foundation, was the sectarian issue and Home Rule versus Ulster's right to stay out. So that was a very divisive aspect. So people naturally tended to concentrate on what united them, which were social and economic issues, and leave the constitutional issue to one side.
Who fears to wear the red hand badge upon his manly breast? What scab obeys the vile command of Murphy and the rest? He's all a slave and half a knave who slights his union thus. But true men like you men will show the badge with us.
Francis Devine singing Who Fears to Wear the Red Hand Badge, the song that becomes the anthem of the workers. The red hand badge is the symbol of the transport union, and workers begin to wear it on their shirts.
Sad and weary days to fight the workers' cause.
In the months running up to the lockout, there's a number of strikes, not just in Dublin, but across Irish cities. Here's David Beggs, General Secretary of the Irish Congress of Trade Unions.
I think there were probably in the year preceding the lockout, there were about 40 serious disputes in Dublin, in which Larkin had made very considerable progress, that he was able to raise wages by about 25% on average. So, of course, the employers began to see him as a mortal threat.
Jim, let nothing dim our ardour in the fray. And true Jim, our own Jim, will win our fight today.
What's making employers nervous is not so much unions, but the idea of rights for the unskilled.
His manly breast, what scab obeys the vile command of Murphy and the rest?
It's hard to imagine now, but a lot of people regarded unskilled workers as scum, basically, and they actually resented them having the temerity to look for rights. And craft worker was one thing. I mean, William Martin Murphy would have said that he had no problem with unions, provided they were respectable unions.
So you do have a complete gulf in terms of attitude, in terms of the rights and the status and standing of these unskilled working men. Now, for his part, it's quite clear. Larkin is in there. He does want to help them, I'm pretty sure, but he's there to create a revolution. And I think we have to bear that in mind. He wants to completely overthrow the existing economic orders, not just to better conditions for these people, but it's to transform society.
So that was simply Larkin's agenda. He simply wanted to organise more employees. But Murphy had a different agenda. He wanted to destroy Larkin.
That's Pádraig Yates, Mary Daly and Labour historian Emmet O'Connor. Thomas Morrissey frames just why it was so important for Murphy to stop Larkin.
He felt himself that for the sake of his own industry, but also for the sake of the city generally as chairman of the Chamber of Commerce, that he had an obligation to stand out against this. He prepared for it. But it's good to remember he was 68 years of age at this stage. He had a very severe illness at the beginning of 1913 and was out for several weeks and then came back with the threatened strike coming up.
With the escalation of industrial conflict, the Catholic Archbishop of Dublin, William Walsh, proposes a mediation scheme for both sides. But conciliation is not what Larkin and Murphy want.
Walsh proposes mediation system, and not just for industrial relations, but for all trade disputes, that from now on, they could all be resolved without resort to strikes or the courts. He went on holidays. William Martin Murphy was quite ill. By July, the Chamber of Commerce and the Trades Council both bought into the idea. In the meantime, Larkin, realising that once the system was in place, it would be difficult to continue a sort of offensive to organise workers. I think his feeling was, if I can get into Guinness's and if I can get into the tramway company and I'm already on the docks and these other areas, we will be the dominant force in Dublin. Murphy, of course, realised this as well. And when he came back, he called a meeting in the Antient concert rooms. And he called it midnight on 19th of July, which is a Saturday night. And he called it midnight so it wouldn't interfere with the tram schedules. And he invited all the employees, and they were offered a free mug of cocoa and a sandwich.
My friends, we cannot disguise from ourselves the fact that an attempt is being made by an organizer outside the company to seduce men for the purpose of inducing them to go on strike. I want you to clearly understand that the directors of this company have not the smallest objection to the men forming a legitimate union. And I would think there is talent enough amongst the men in the service to form a union of their own without allying themselves under the feet of an unscrupulous man who claims the right to give you the word of command and issue his orders to you and to use you as tools to make him the Labour dictator of Dublin. What is demanded of you is that you bow down before this gentleman. You are to answer his call and obey his commands. I am here to tell you that this word of command will never be given, and if it is, that it will be the Waterloo for Mr. Larkin. A strike in the tramway would, no doubt, produce turmoil and disorder created by the roughs and looters. But what chance would the men without funds have in a contest with the company who could and would spend £100,000 or more? You must recollect, when dealing with a company of this kind, that every one of the shareholders, to the number of 5, 6, or 7,000, will have 3 meals a day, whether the men succeed or not. I don't know if the men who go out can count on this. The directors, therefore, intend to stamp out this incipient rebellion, which is being organized outside the company's staff. We have heard that certain hot-headed young men have been attempting to coerce, by force and threats, other men in the service to join the association. And we certainly shall prevent any man in our service using threats and intimidation against any other man to force him to join the association. We have given authority to the manager to summarily dismiss any man who is guilty of that conduct, and he can go to Mr. Larkin for his pay.
By mid-August, Murphy begins to carry out his threat. He instructs workers at the Irish Independence dispatch room to choose either the union or their job. 30 are sacked. Things escalate quickly. By August 21st, 100 tramway workers are sacked. They're told their services are no longer required since they're members of a union whose methods are disorganising the trade and business of the city. The Red Hand badge becomes the defining mark. Sympathy action hits Eason's, the distributor of Murphy's newspapers, and then spreads to the docks. Union members are being dismissed. It's the beginning of an employer's lockout. Larkin has little option but to react.
They had a meeting on the Sunday night, one of several, at which the workers demanded that Larkin bring them out on strike, and his own instincts told them not to, and he persuaded them not to come out. More men were sacked the next day and had another meeting late the following night. They gave an ultimatum. Either he brought them out or they left the union. And I think there were intimations if they left the union, they'd be attacking it or denouncing him as a sham or whatever. And he decided he had nothing to lose at that stage, so he brought them out.
Does this car go to Ball's Bridge or does it not?
That more or less depends on the time, sir.
What the deuce can the time have to do with it? You either go to Ball's Bridge or you don't.
You tell me the time and I tell you the answer.
The time? The time is exactly 10 o'clock.
Then it doesn't, sir.
You see, incorrigible. I warned you about it. What on earth are you putting in your buttonhole?
My trade union badge, sir. The Red Hand. I'm not allowed to wear it on duty.
Then what the devil are you putting it in your buttonhole for?
Because I'm no longer on duty, sir. I'm on strike.
On the morning of Tuesday, August 26th, on the first day of the Dublin Horse Show, Larkin calls a tramway strike. The strike starts at 9:50, the time when most union drivers are crossing O'Connell Street.
The tram stopped and the men donned the Red Hand badge of the union, and that was the start of a struggle. Murphy had anticipated that, and he had relief crews actually sitting in the offices in O'Connell Street. And he even went to the trouble of getting spare handles because some of the guys thought, I'll take the handle with me so they can't start the tram again. And the men arrived with the spare handles so they could start. So within about 40 minutes, the trams were working again.
Larkin's decision to call the strike played into Murphy's hand, but few could have anticipated that what began so casually would result in riots, fatalities, and the city's 400 employers locking out 20,000 workers in a six-month battle. And it's a battle not just for the hearts and minds of citizens, but also their souls, as Larkin and Connolly clash with Archbishop Walsh over what becomes known as the Kiddie Scheme. In our next episode, we focus on the lockout itself, on Bloody Sunday, and on that confrontation between Larkin and Murphy in the Asquith inquiry that follows.
We are out to break down racial and sectarian barriers. My suggestion to the employers is that if they want peace, we are prepared to meet them. But if they want war, then war they will have.